Well, tonight we're going to talk once again about our series on the history of worship, but we really have started a new section on that, taking a look at the patriarchal worship. We are now turning to something I really wanted to look at. One of my major motivations of getting into this study and writing this book is that I've always wanted to do some research on exactly how and why and exactly when men started turning away from God and began to worship idols. And we're going to look at the next few lessons, some incredible evidence. So this becomes a lesson of worship, a study of why and how and when this pagan idolatry began, but it also becomes really an evidence to re-solidify our view in biblical history and therefore in God. And I feel a little selfish in this because having grown up in a church and in a religion, then studying the Bible in depth and learning that I was awry in my faith and in the direction I was headed, changing my life, I really wanted to make sure and dedicate myself to make sure that where I was headed was where I was supposed to head, and that my faith is not in vain. And so anytime I can find this evidence that just secures my confidence in God and His Word, I really just like that. I love that. And I like to share that with others. And I think that's what we have as we take a look at the what I call the pattern of idolatry, the start of idolatry. I'm going to start with what I call my premise. This is all the timeline of how I believe idolatry started after the flood. And we did a lesson last time basically showing this very thing. But I call it my premise and not the biblical outline, though I believe everything I'm going to show you is biblical, because Moses is not writing to say, here, I want you to understand where idolatry started and how it started and all of that. And so that's not his purpose, though I believe you can look at what he writes and you can to glean exactly what I'm showing. So I'm trying to be very honest with the hearer, with the reader, that this is my premise. And of course, it all starts with Noah and the flood and the ark, because obviously, whatever idolatry was there before, it is not there anymore. It's the very reason that God has brought forth the flood, and all of those that have chosen to serve their own ways and their own gods are now gone. And out of the ark comes eight individuals, as we look at our timeline. And no doubt, as Noah and his sons and their wives leave the ark, they not only worship God. In fact, as we looked at, the very first thing Noah does is he builds an altar and he offers sacrifice to God. And no doubt, as they have children and they multiply over the face of the earth, and then they have grandchildren and great-grandchildren. In fact, Noah lives, you know, quite a long life to be there through many generations. No doubt they are teaching them about God, about starting all over through them, about the flood. And so generation after generation is being told these stories from Noah, from his sons, from the grandsons, all the way down. Now, just a little aside, you know, when you really start to think of it, it's just mind-boggling when you think about how many people are on the face of this earth right now, spread over all these continents, the billions of people that are on this globe we call the earth, and that all of them, of all of their difference in skin color and culture and what have you, they all came from these four couples. They all came from these eight people. And though the earth hasn't been around for millions and millions of years, it's been around a while, to where we all of these people come from Noah and his sons. It's an incredible thought to me, how long it takes, or would it take, or really how quickly it happens that we have all these people. We're all brothers and sisters in our old sense, and that we come back from that. But there's a connection to that idea. We talked last time that it seems that Moses is recording not only confusion of the languages, but in the Tower of Babel, that he's trying to show us this is the first signs of where there's a generation that has come that chooses not to praise the name of God, but to make a name for themselves. Not to look up and serve the God of heaven, but to build a tower that will reach up into heaven. And of course, as we said, that it appears that this takes place about 100 years after the flood. And so we start to see what happens. God confuses, God divides. And so they're divided into eventually nations. And they form their own culture, they form their own religions. And so at this point, what happens is that idolatry explodes as all these nations are forming their own religions, their own gods, their own way of worshiping. I believe this is the timeline, the biblical timeline. That's my premise of how idolatry starts and how it really explodes into the world. So that when we start looking at the time of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, it just seems like it's widespread all over the world, and it is at that point. But my premise of this is that even though Noah's descendants turned away from God and to idols, that the knowledge and the worship of Yahweh crept into their pagan religion. Andrew talked a little bit about this in regards to the new converts in Corinth and the Lord's Supper and the love feast. That, where did all that come from? All this messing up of the Lord's Supper, turning it into this physical love feast. Well, it's because what they knew. And they took what they knew from their past and they brought it into their new life, into Christ, and that's not the way it works. Well, I truly believe that even though we start looking at all of these pagan nations serving all of these different gods, creating all these different gods and their way to worship and serve these gods, that we're going to see a connection back to the fact that they were one people who spoke one language, who served one God. And they go all the way back to Noah, and we're going to see a connection not only to Noah, but to the flood and to Yahweh himself. It's just what we do as a people. We start something new, and we take the influences of the past, and it creeps into the newness. One of the most obvious signs, I think, of this, isn't it interesting? We've talked about over and over, how did the patriarchs worship Yahweh? They build an altar and they offer sacrifice to him. How do the pagans worship their gods? They built an altar and they offered animal sacrifices. Why? Why the similarity? Could it be that there's simply the past creeping into their new pagan religion? That's exactly what I think is going on. And so we're simply going to make our connections to these pagan rituals, these pagan traditions, their history, and just see that it goes all the way back to Noah and the flood. Now, take that timeline I just showed you. What do you think about an atheistic evolutionary view? What would their timeline look like? They obviously would not agree with the timeline I just have up here. Number one, they deny the flood. They don't believe in the biblical story of the flood. We'll talk a little bit more about that in just a second. So what would their timeline look like? What would an evolutionary atheistic view explain how we get all these nations and all these different pagan idolatrous religions? Well, from my study, we can't start with the ark and the flood because, like I said, they don't believe in that. So they believe over millions of years, man eventually evolves from a single cell to multiple cells, from apes into eventually into man. But from what I've studied, what I've understand, don't get the concept that you just have this one group of apes and then a man or men come from them and then they evolve and then eventually they spread. I believe the idea is that you've got apes here in this continent, maybe we say apes from Africa, and then you have some that are over in Europe and some over here in Asia. And as they evolve, this group over here in Asia evolves, men who become the Asians, and this group becomes the Africans, and these become the Europeans. And that's how it all evolves, that they didn't just start from one group and then come exist and then scatter, but they were already scattered as they evolve. And so man, by the time he evolves, he's already scattered into groups on these continents. And so, in essence, what would you expect to find? Out of this scattering, out of this evolutionary process from ape to man, comes groups that are nations and culture and their own religion. But looking at this, here's the key. You wouldn't expect to be any connection. If any connection, it would be a very little connection between these groups and the stories that they tell in the history. Because, well, the men in Asia, they can't fly over to Africa. They're so far away. And over to Europe and so forth. And so you have a very different existence of these two timelines. But now, take a look at the history. Like I said, just the connection to the flood. Compare that timeline to this timeline, which I believe is the biblical timeline, what the Bible states. And now let's talk about the flood. Did the flood actually happen? Many atheists, evolution, many people claim, no, it never happened. Would you just think about that? No, there was not a worldwide flood that covered the face of the earth. Okay? Say it never happened. Others claim that there was only local flood or local floods, and that the story, the biblical story, is greatly exaggerated, that it's just a... they were just a bunch of local floods here and there and so forth. And that's what the stories that we learn when we come to these flood stories. Well, we talk about the floods and the pagans. George Frazier, in his book called The Folklore in the Old Testament, he says in his research he has found flood stories are found on every continent except Antarctica. Why is that continent excluded? Well, no one lives there. But you have flood stories found in Europe, Africa, Asia, Australia, the East Indies, Polynesia, South, Central, and North America. All of these people on all these continents all tell flood stories. Let's add to that. Derek Allen, J. Bernard Dallaire, say in their book that there is in existence over 500 flood accounts. 500 flood stories. Now, in all fairness, there are some that say, no, the more conservative, there's 200, not 500. I don't know where the disconnect is. But even if we just use 200 flood accounts, number one, how can people say there was never a flood in the first place when there are 200 different nations or groups of people, tribes, that all tell a flood story? Does that not lend to itself that there was a flood and people are telling about it or writing about it? And secondly, with just that type of information, which of those timelines does that type of evidence point to? It doesn't point to the evolutionary atheistic timeline. They're not supposed to know what's going on. They're separated already. But people that once all spoke the same language, all came from the same people who were in the flood, well, that makes a lot more sense. That all these people are writing about floods. There's an interesting tradition. I don't know how true this is, but I think it does relate to the idea that there is this known history, not only the flood, but there's this known history of what happened before the flood. Austin Henry Layard, a student and an expert on Assyrian history, says there's an Assyrian tradition that states that Seth, the son of Adam, the replacement of Abel, who lived to be 912 years old, recorded the pre-deluge, the flood history, pre-flood history, on burnt and unburned bricks. So that those that were burned would withstand a flood, and those that were unburned would withstand fire, as they would only become hardened. And so I guess the idea is that Seth figured at some point there might be some catastrophe. It might be a flood. It might be a fire of some sort. And so he wanted this pre-catastrophe history known. And so he made it on these bricks that would either withstand a flood or withstand fire. Again, I don't know if that's definitely true or not, but it's an interesting tradition. And it's not necessarily denying the inspiration of Moses. Many writers used secular historical writings in writing their inspired text. Paul did it. The gospel writers did it. Perhaps Moses had this to his disposal. But notice the Syrian count believes in Seth, a biblical character, perhaps the only one that is found, or the Bible, the only source that speaks of Seth. So, for the rest of our time, I just wanted to show you some examples of some of these flood stories. We are not going, you can rest assured, to look at all 200 or all 500 tonight, but I want to show you some of the oldest ones. And what I'm really interested in is not just the whole story itself, but I want you to look at these pagan stories, their history that they recorded of the flood, and how they parallel the biblical story. They shouldn't do that, but they do. So the oldest flood account outside of the Bible, is known as the Babylonian flood story. Okay? And here is the parallels to the Babylonian story of the flood and the biblical story. Now, what would we expect? We would expect them to, yes, take the stories of the Bible and pervert them and distort them, because this is being, what? These are pagans telling the story. And they're not going to talk about Yahweh necessarily. They're going to talk about their gods and their people. But even in that, notice, number one, the Babylonian flood story parallels the Bible in this way. That there was a warning that a flood was coming upon the earth. The earth. Not just a local area, but the earth. Number two, a certain man in their tradition, he was the 10th king of Babylon. And it might help you to understand and remember, if you can, for future lessons, the emphasis placed on kings that are now deceased. That may not make sense, but later on we'll talk about that in regards to the creating of gods, their gods. But they believe there was a certain man, he was in fact the 10th king of Babylon, and he was commanded, I would imagine, by their gods to build a ship. On this ship he was to take food and animals, including birds. Now isn't it interesting that birds are highlighted among all the animals? Can you think of a reason why that might be? Number four, the man also had his family aboard the ship. But there's other parallels. Number five, when the flood water subsided, remember that? The birds were sent out, but since there was no place for them to rest, they returned to the ship. Of all the animals in the flood story, in the biblical story, it's the birds that are highlighted for this very same reason. Number six, on the third attempt, birds were released from the ship, but this time they didn't return, thus telling the waters had subsided. Again, Does that point to just a local flood? Or is this story telling us about a global flood? This is not the biblical story. This is the Babylonian story of the flood. Number seven, the ship came to rest on a mountain. The man left the ship, number eight, and as his first act upon returning to dry ground, he built an altar and offered sacrifices. Now, obviously, in their story, he's going to be offering sacrifices to the Babylonian gods, but you see the parallel, don't you? Now, which timeline that we've looked at tonight would this point to? Notice the tie-in to the biblical story. The Babylonian flood story, to just add a few things here. Of interest, the man and his wife are rewarded for their obedience and taken up to be with the gods. The surviving people, or the people beyond them, are told that the mountain the ship rested on was called Armenia. Many believe this is where the ark still resides today under layers of ice. Remember that one summer we talked about Don Patton and his search for the ark? Where did he believe the ark was? On a mountain in Armenia. The legend also states that the ship survived many days after the flood and that people would visit it, remove some of the wood, and use that wood of the ark for certain incantations and charms. Now, it's interesting because that same legend, that same myth about the ark is mentioned by Josephus, who we use all the time for his history and connection with the Bible. You can read that. I won't take the whole time to read that. But one of the things that Josephus does is he uses the multiple flood stories that are out there in existence to do the very thing that we're talking about, to show a connection back to the existence of the Bible and Yahweh. So even Josephus talks about people visiting the ark and taking wood for their own purposes. Let's talk about two more ancient flood stories. One of them is called the Gilgamesh Epic. I would imagine most of us have heard that, this Gilgamesh flood story. The other is called, or is recorded on a prism called the Weld Blundell Prism, in which from here on out I'll just call it the prism story, just for shortness. But as you look at these two stories, here's how they parallel the biblical story. A man who builds a boat to save himself from a coming flood. Number two, the man loads the boat with his family and both domesticated and wild animals. Number three, the boat lands on a mountain. The man released both a dove and a raven to see if the waters had subsided. The prism story includes a tapering off of lifespans after the flood, just like the Genesis account. One of the things that when you see the timeline, the genealogies after the flood, you start to see man's lifespan starts to decrease. It almost goes like from 50% and then 30 and down a ways. This prism story does the same thing. And not only that, it has stories that closely parallel Genesis 5, which is the genealogy of Seth, all the way down to Noah. And then it also parallels Genesis 11. What's the Tower of Babel story. A lot of these pagan stories connect back to the Tower of Babel. Which timeline would that seem to fit? Let's go over to the continent of Asia and talk about some of their flood stories. This is actually from Professor Holmberg and his Mythology of All Races. One particular flood story that he talks of a particular Asian tribe, and that story parallels the biblical story. The gods came to one of their ancestors and commanded him to build a boat. And so he began his construction in the forest, where there would be wood and I guess open space. Number two, the devil talked the wife into behaving a certain way to her husband so that the devil could sneak aboard the ship. Now you say to me, wait a second. That doesn't sound like the story of Noah. Well, hold on to that thought. We're going to come back to that. But notice there is this character known as the devil. And he's wanting to fight against what this builder of the ship is doing. The builder of the ship gathered some of all animals in the ship, with the exception of a couple of huge animals which would not fit. One of these was the mammoth. That woolly mammoth. And all I do is I put that up there because not only to show that animals were on board, but even from the ancient times, they're trying to understand and explain why these very large animals went extinct, didn't exist. Now, I don't know if that's what actually happened to the woolly mammoth. He wasn't small enough to fit on the ark. That doesn't seem to fit the biblical story. But it's interesting that they put that there. Number four, a flood that threatened the whole world came upon the earth, killing all that remained. Look at that number four. Does that sound like a local flood? That's not the story they're telling. That everyone died as it covered the earth that remained on the earth. Now let me tell you about another Asian group known as the Segiais. This is their flood story and how it parallels. Their builder of the boat is named Noj. N-O-J. I believe in Hebrew, Noah is simply spelled N-O-A. It is quite possible that this is in their dialect, their language, the spelling of Noah. How they would spell Noah. It's so similar. Isn't that interesting? Number two, the devil is presented in this story also. And he tempts Noah's wife to question her husband as to what he is doing. Notice in these two Asian stories, you've got the devil in existence and he's working on the wife to try to get access or try to thwart the plans of the builder. In verse number three, when the devil learns of this, he begins to destroy at night the work that Noj completes during the day. Noj collects all animals upon the boat, saving them from the flood. So let's talk about these two stories about the devil working on the wife. These two flood stories not only connect back to the biblical story, but it appears that they go all the way back to the story of Eve being tempted by the devil. Now, do they have the whole history correct? No. But notice you've got the story of the devil, and what's he doing? He's tempting, he's working on the wife so that he can then get to the husband. And many people believe what's happened is that, not knowing the biblical actual story, the true story, that they've combined these stories of Eve and the devil and Noah. Heath Sisman, in his book, The Devil's Door, says, pagans had a dualistic concept of good and evil where the sons of Adam and Eve are confused with the sons of Noah. They mixed those stories up. And you just got to see two examples of how that all worked out. So when you look at these flood stories, and there's a lot more we could look at, but this gives you a little taste of different people on different continents, not just telling a flood story. Yeah, they're different in a lot of ways in the biblical story, but you can see the main elements of these stories. Which timeline does that seem to fit? Does it seem to fit all of these scattered, evolved groups that have no connection to one another? No. And in fact, the most interesting thing is they're all talking about a global flood, not a local flood. Or does it fit this timeline, where it shows people going back, evidence of them knowing a people that spoke the same language, that served the same God, that came through the flood? I think it's exactly what we see. And all we brought up tonight is the story of the flood. In another lesson, we're going to take a look at other connections of these pagan people. Are they worshiping Yahweh? No. But you're going to see that there is a knowledge of Yahweh, of Noah, and of all that came before. It carries on into their new life. Evidence like this should give us great confidence in the biblical stories, even when men say they never happened, or they didn't happen that way, they happened on a smaller scale. If you would take a songbook, turn to Song of Invitation tonight. We've been looking at the great evidence for God, for His Word. That same Word that says, "Come to me," says Jesus. An invitation to wash away our sins, to be His child, to follow Jesus to a place that God says is real, a place called heaven. If we can help you do that with great faith and great confidence tonight, why don't you come as together we stand and as we sing.